Welcome to the May 16th, 2022 Education Finance Conference Committee. I'm Representative Jim Davney. Mr. Lee, will you please call the roll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House roll call. Chair Davney?
Present.
Representative Richardson?
Present.
Representative Sandstead?
Present.
Representative Hassan?
Present.
Representative Erickson?
Erickson, present.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Donovan, would you please call the Senate?
Chair Chamberlain?
Here.
Justin, here. Senator Eichhorn?
Present.
Senator Duckworth?
Here.
Senator Coleman?
Present.
Senator Wieger?
Here. Thank you, Ms. Donovan. Members and members of the public, as is being reported in the press, the legislative leadership and the governor reached a framework last night for ending the session successfully and on time. That framework includes a budget target for the K-12 area of $1 billion over the next 3 years, investing in our students and staff and schools and communities. It's, to put a little finer point on it, a $320 million investment in fiscal year 23, and then $680 million investment in fiscal years 24 and 25. The Senate Chair and I were able to speak yesterday. We have an agreement that both bodies would bring a offer today balanced to those targets, and we'll exchange them at the end of the meeting. That does tighten up our time a little bit. We had not, in planning this meeting, anticipated that agreement this weekend. Pleased to have it, just hadn't anticipated it necessarily happening. But we'll want to have time to review both proposals and give both parties, both bodies, the opportunity to hit the highlights that they wish to drive into the discussion. Mr. Chair, any comment?
Just going to let you know, we have not had time to finish our proposal yet, but we are working on it.
All right. Thank you very much.
I will add that, you know, we gave you a small one last Thursday, initial stroke at this, but so there is still that out there from last Thursday, but we don't have any other one yet. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, was there any guidance from leadership regarding a deadline?
There was. Thank you for that question, Senator Wieger. The Speaker has been very clear in reminding members of the House majority that we cannot pass bills next Monday. And I think, based on her tone of voice alone, the sooner the better. She's looking for, the House is looking for an orderly and respectful end to the session. Mr. Chair?
So is the Senate. We have an easy plan, I think. You'll love it. Very short and simple.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we've both, in both of our proposals, focused on academic success for Minnesota students. An important component of that, necessary but not sufficient perhaps, is literacy. And an important component of literacy is English language learner students. We want to spend a little time on that this morning. We've got the privilege of having Representative Cowley Herr from St. Paul to kick us off. Representative Herr, if you'd please come forward. Representative Herr, you know the drill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Glad to have you here today.
Thank you, Chair Davney. I'm State Representative Kali Vang Herr, and I'm here to speak to all of you today on EL and the importance of funding it. Chair Davney, Chair Chamberlain, and Conference Committee members. I ran here from the House, so my apologies. I'm a little winded here. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak to you on the EL provisions in the Ed Finance and Policy Bill. This provision seeks to do two things, increase the English language learner per pupil amount and to eliminate the cross-subsidy. Back in 2019, I shared that the EL population was growing faster than the rate of enrollment, and that over 40% of school districts across the state had a shortfall in their EL funding totaling $104 million. Not only did this trend continue over the last few years, but the need to invest in our EL student is more urgent than ever with the pandemic that we experienced these last few years. In February, I asked MDE to provide disaggregated data on our AAPI community. Hmong and Karen students are now only 14% proficient in math and 30% proficient in English and in reading. The past 2 years of distance learning with a lack of resources to support EL learners has widened the achievement gap for our EL students. The EL learner population in Minnesota has increased almost 200% in the last 20 years. The most recent census indicates this population will continue to grow around the state, not just the metro area. The state funding formula has not been updated to reflect this change during the same time period. The $2 million bump last year was a first step, but MDE has reported that districts are short nearly $147 million for critical EL services and professional training necessary for students to achieve state and federal standards. It is important to point out that that is a 41% increase in the shortfall from when I first presented this information in committee a couple of years ago. Lack of funding for this growing population has led to high student-teacher ratios, outdated curriculum, insufficient professional development for our educators, inadequate family support, and the inability to invest in students for success. Furthermore, English language learner proficiency was added to the federal accountability plan for the 2018-2019 school year with the goal of having 85% of English language learners proficient by 2025. The U.S. Department of Education requires that students who qualify for English language development services must receive appropriate language assistance services that are educationally sound in theory and effective in practice. One of the most common findings that the U.S. Department of Justice and the Office of Civil Rights have when they review state and district EL programs is failure to sufficiently staff and support language assistance for EL students. I'm sure that this body is aware that the state demographer has been saying what they've been saying for years, that we do have a worker shortage in, we will have a worker shortage in not the so distant future. One way to fill this gap is to continue our state's rich tradition of welcoming immigrants and refugees. What we know is that ELs who have not fully mastered English by high school have only about a 40% chance of completing high school and acquiring a diploma. The proposed language phases in revenues to school districts over 4 years to address the EL underfunding so that districts can provide effective EL services and instructions to ensure students are career and college ready. A successful Minnesota economy will depend in part on our EL population to fill critical jobs across the state. I think that this is especially important as we're thinking about the budget surplus and the time to invest in our students. Lastly, I would be remiss if I did not mention, I shared this story a couple of years ago, but I am an EL student. I was an EL student. As a refugee from Laos, English was not my first language. I remember distinctly when the characters in my dreams, when I would dream at night, was switching from Hmong to English. I was in middle school. As a preteen, I thought it odd and didn't know what it meant. What I know now is that that was the moment when English was solidified in my cognition. That was the moment in which I was no longer learning the technical aspect of language, but experiencing it. It was the moment that anything I dreamed of, I knew that I could be. I ask that you fund EL students, teachers, and educators so that the future generations of students that will have the same opportunities as I did to live the American dream and to contribute to this great country the way I have been able to. Thank you, chairs and committee members, for listening to my testimony this morning.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Questions for Representative Herr? I think you covered it.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. We have two additional testifiers exploring the connection between English language. Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, thank you, sir. Representative Hassan.
Sorry, I don't have a question, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Rep. Herr for her comments and testimony. I also was an ELL student. I remember my ELL teacher, teacher Miss Lee, I hope she's watching somewhere today. I spent a few years in her class. I spent most of my first few years in this country in her class, just learning English. And I have very fond memories of her. and many of our, you know, ELL students, ELL class is their first introduction to American culture and American way of life. That's how you learn how things are done in America. That's how you learn everything. Not only did she teach me English, but she also taught me many things in American life. And I'm very thankful for her and appreciate all the effort that she put into my education. That's why I'm very supportive of, like, you know, fully funding this, the ELL, you know, cross subsidy, and for once taking the burden off of, you know, schools, so then our students can learn and become, you know, full, you know, join the workforce and become contributing members of society. I don't even know what my comments were, but I just wanted to thank Rep her for her comments, and just wanted to share that it was also something that was significant for me, and it's something that's significant for many students. So while we make decisions in the last few days of our time here, I just want us to be very cognizant of the importance of ELL funding for many of our students, our Black students, our Asian students, and our Latinx students, and many of the students from other countries who are not only adjusting to the life in America, but also are learning. There's a huge burden on their shoulders. You have to learn and adjust at the same time. So they don't have a whole lot of, like, time to adjust. The first day you get here, a few days later you attend school, and you're supposed to figure that out on your own. So I just want to thank every teacher out there who's an ELL teacher, who's, you know, who has students who don't understand, but are passionate enough to just, like, stick with them, hold their hand, tell them that everything is going to be okay, and see those students graduate and you know, join the workforce and contribute to our society. Thank you to all ELL teachers.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. Thank you, Representative Herr. Next on our agenda is Christina Robertson, Multilingual Program and Equity Administrator with the Roseville Public Schools. Ms. Robertson? Welcome to the committee.
Yes.
Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure.
Appreciate your taking time out of your day to join us.
Thank you for allowing me to be here. This is a topic I'm very passionate about, and I'm glad that you're considering it. My name is Christina Robertson. I am the Multilingual Program and Equity Administrator for Roseville Area Schools. We're a small district of about 7,500 students. 60% of our students are students of color, and 35% of all of our students have a home language other than English. So for a small district, we have a lot going on, and we're very proud of what we do. Our motto is equity in all we do. So we really do prioritize that. I'm here today to tell you about an opportunity that I think you will want to be part of because it will be very visionary. We have been underfunding our English learner programming. We have not had a raise since about 2000, so that's 22 years since we last had a raise for EL funding. And so the opportunity is that by increasing English learner funding, you will make a difference in our economy and in the lives of many, many students and families. In the 2005 Mind the Gap report, they predicted that by the year 2029, 350,000 highly skilled jobs would be leaving the economy, that they would need to be replaced by new workers with high technical skills. So in the report, they say that even if every single high school student graduates career and college ready, we still may not have enough to fill all of those gaps. That was before the pandemic, right? Right now, our graduation rate in the state for all students is 83%. For English learners, it's 64%. These are students who come with multilingual, multicultural skills that can really enhance our economy and build us up after the pandemic. In our career and college seminar class, the top three careers that students investigate and often go into are teaching, healthcare, and policing. These are three areas that are critical for us to recover from the pandemic and continue to grow, especially with bilingual, bicultural workers. So I want to tell you about a success story, because when we work with our English learners, they often, of course, want to go into community-based careers, but they also often want to come back and give back to the community that enriched their lives. So Neetha Gay was a student who came to us in fourth grade, and just last year, I was excited to be able to hire her in our district as an ESL teacher. She is Karen. She spent the first 10 years of her life in a refugee camp. Her parents were not educated. And she still talks about the first day she came to school, and Miss Heidi, the EL teacher, met her at the door, her and her siblings, and she said that they spent the first 2 weeks following her around like baby ducklings because they had no idea what was going on, what anybody was saying. But Miss Heidi was able to make them feel comfortable. She was a trusted adult. She helped them learn not just the language, but also the culture of school and what was expected and what they would be doing. Neetha Gay became a successful student. She continued to develop her language skills and her academic skills, and she went on to Northwestern College, where she decided she would be a teacher. She was valedictorian of her class, and then we were very honored that she selected us first to come back, and she remembers every single one of her ESL teachers, and she says they are the reason she is successful. She said, they understand me. They were able to take assignments and make them accessible so I could really understand what I needed to do, and I always felt safe asking for their support. These are the kinds of educators that we need in our system right now if we are going to create that workforce of police, healthcare, and teachers. A lot of these students are not seen or not heard by the majority of our school system. Language is a civil right. In order to develop it, we need support. Second language acquisition does not just happen. You can sit in a class hearing English, interacting with some content, and still not be able to say it. So I very dramatically say to my staff all the time, if the students don't say it in your classroom, they're never going to say it. Because no kid gets on the bus after school and says, hey, let's talk about those parallelograms again. Wasn't that fun? They're not going to say it. They need to say it at least 5 times in every classroom before they even feel comfortable with the word parallelogram. What kind of word is that anyway? English is a very difficult language. So I'd just like to point out as well, as like funding resources, if you look at, I think of Ms. Schostad, my fifth grade teacher in the 70s. She was amazing. I loved her. Learned so much from her. Her schedule in the 70s is not very different from what teachers experience today. One classroom teacher cannot do it all. In the 70s, Ms. Schostad had a classroom, textbooks. Everybody did the same thing. She had a break for her prep, 50 minutes. We still have that today, but we have diverse learners, special education students, English learners, poverty, and pandemic to recover from. It is not enough for one teacher to be able to do all of those things. We need additional support. Finally, I will just say that we also need to remember with English learners, they come at all different ages and with all different literacy backgrounds. We have many students who come in the secondary grades and they have not had an opportunity to learn in their native language, much less English. So our district cross-subsidized English learner services at 2-to-1. So $2 million of our district funds for $1 million that comes from the state. We need paraprofessionals, cultural liaisons, social workers, bilingual resources, lots of different things to support our students. Currently, the state graduation rate is 83% for all and 64% for EL. Our current graduation rate is 79% for EL. We are very, very proud of that, and that is because our district has continued to put additional resources into that. So you have an opportunity to consider these facts and increase funding and support for English learners and therefore improve lives and our economy. Thank you for your time.
And thank you, Ms.
I have a handout for you here, too, that kind of goes over some of these things I said. So I'll give these to Sarah.
If staff can support the distribution of that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Robertson, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next is Sam Oak, Director of Equity and Inclusion for the Prior Lake Savage Area Schools. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Sam Oak, Director of Education and Inclusion for the Prior Lake Savage Area Schools. This is my very first time testifying, so forgive me if I come off a little nervous, but good morning to all of you. My name is Sam Oak. I am currently the Director of Equity and Inclusion for the Prior Lake Savage Area Schools. Part of my duties as Director of Equity and Inclusion is to oversee the English learner programming. This is what I do now. However, prior to this current year, my service in the English Learner Program has been as a coordinator in two different districts and a teacher in the program in three different districts in two different countries, the U.S. and Brazil. But I started in the EL program as a student. My family were genocide survivors who escaped the Cambodian killing fields to eventually call Minnesota home. I was welcomed into the small Rochester, Minnesota school with no EL program at the time. I remember my first year and a half of school seeing with my own eyes and hearing through an interpreter, teachers, admins, and other students spending most of their time questioning what was wrong with me because I didn't know how to ask to go to the bathroom. I got into fights with other kids who constantly laughed at me, and I spent countless minutes in the timeout chair because I was doing dangerous stunts on the playground trying to win over friends. Luckily, before my mother, who was a single parent, and I started believing what people were saying about my incapabilities, we heard that there was another school in the district that had an EL program and a center for new-to-country kids with other students from Cambodia learning English. Once our rent lease was up, my mother moved us out and rented a home in the school's zone so that I can be taught how to speak, read, and write in English, instead of being thrown into a general ed classroom with a desk in the back corner. With EL support, I eventually learned a few words so I can share with other students what food I like to eat, what games I like to play, and I can share with my teachers why some days I struggle to learn. For example, at 7 years old, I told my teacher that I did not know my father, whom we thought died in the killing fields, was still alive until I was five. And I often spend my school days wondering when or if he would ever get to be with us again so I can have a mother and father like other kids. The English Learner Program has always been underfunded. I realized this as a student and as a teacher in the program. As a student, my English Learner class was in the basement right next to the boiler room. It was loud and cold, but I was one of the lucky ones. Many of my friends had classes underneath stairwells and in hallways, learning simple nouns and sounds in third, fourth, or fifth grade, while other students walked by, wondering why we were so illiterate. When I became the coordinator of the program in 2010, not much has changed. I still saw teachers not having proper classrooms and a new generation of students having to go through the same humiliation I went through. To this day, we have rural teachers traveling between three different districts. In my district of Prior Lake, I have an EL teacher split between two buildings and sixth grade levels within each building, accommodating four different language levels, teaching students from six different continents. There are over 76,000 EL students in the state of Minnesota, many of whom are refugees, unaccompanied minors, asylum seekers who have had tremendous trauma and loss in their lives. Is this how we want to welcome them into our schools? Through an underfunded EL program? Speaking from my experience as a refugee in Minnesota, I can tell you that the refugee journey doesn't end when you arrive in the United States. The refugee journey ends when we can rebuild that sense of home. Because for many of us, our lives are like a broken puzzle. Even when we manage to put the pieces back together, there are missing pieces that often mean more than the pieces that are there. Therefore, increasing service through a general ed lens by offering more reading support or having us march to the counselor or social worker without the advocate of an EL teacher is just simply wrong. Providing those support is good, but it's limiting for an EL student because it is starting at the wrong place. And it is wrong to look at an EL teacher or the EL program as only about academic language. No. Academic language in English is what the EL student needs to be proficient, to be successful in school. However, to get our students to proficiency, EL teachers help the students and families navigate the system of school in a culturally responsive manner to minimize cultural dissonance. The EL teacher is the bridge for students to succeed in other academic areas. They engage families in a way that empowers them and connects the general differences between students and parents. For SLIFE students who have interrupted education or come into school for the first time at an older age, the EL teacher is often at the same time their elementary, their middle school, and their high school go-to teacher, helping them through all subject areas. My elementary teacher was so important in my life that and the lives of my friends that we visited her every day on the last day of school from seventh grade up until we graduated. For Minnesota, increasing EL funding is vital. We also need to look at how we can elevate the understanding of English learners, their lived experiences, and better ways to enhance their education. With English learners having been one of the fastest growing groups in Minnesota and nationwide for many years, proper attention and support to the EL program has long been overdue. I thank you for your time and allowing me to share my thoughts with you today.
Mr. Oak, thank you for sharing your story and sharing your testimony today. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson, I see you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions for the commissioner.
Oh, all right. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and commissioner. Don't we use the WIDA standards? I know that I was the chair of policy when we adopted those. And the first standard of WIDA, as I recall, is social and instructional. And then it goes into the academic areas of language, arts, math, science, and social studies. So to what extent are these schools that have especially large EL populations following the WIDA standards?
Commissioner?
Chair Javney and Representative Erickson, thank you very much for the question. And we do have our schools that are still utilizing the WIDA standards. We actually also are able to utilize assessments based on those WIDA standards and use personalized learning plans to help to monitor where students are in their progress through those WIDA standards, and so being able to meet those expectations.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. So EL funding is linked to the basic skills funding. Do you recall when we began that? I think it might have been the 80s. Do you recall when EL funding was rolled into basic skills?
I don't.
Commissioner?
I'm sorry. Chair Davney and Representative Erickson, I don't recall that time frame, but I can certainly check and get back to you.
Representative Erickson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And finally, Commissioner, what do we do for reclassification for our EL students?
Commissioner?
Chair Davney and Representative Erickson, so in that process, we're able to help to identify as students are taking their the assessments that align with the WIDA standards. We are able to identify what those levels are, and then at basic specific levels, oftentimes at 4, 5, or 6, students have the opportunity to then exit and or be monitored, and then be monitored for ongoing support. And so at specific levels, students are exited from EL programming. Students have the opportunity to have access outside of some of those EL supports, but there is consistent monitoring that is happening to ensure that as students are engaging more in general education classrooms with less EL support, that there are still supports available to them.
Representative Erickson.
Yeah, just thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the average for an EL student from beginning to ending so that they have the ability to interact and to understand our language, arts, math, et cetera?
Commissioner?
Chair Davney and Representative Erickson, we know that based on the research that there is oftentimes 7 years that is needed to be able to get to the level of understanding and basic skills of the English language. We also know that this may not be the student's first language or second language. English acquisition may be their third, fourth, or fifth language. It really is also dependent on the individual student. There is not necessarily a norm, but we do know that there are up to 7 years, which is why we are also having graduation standards that go to 7 years, is that sometimes that is needed.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions on English language learners and its connection to our literacy issues? All right. Thank you to the testifiers. Appreciate your time this morning. Moving on, we want to touch back on early childhood. There was some interesting conversation on Friday, if I recall correctly. And one interaction there was law enforcement support for investments in early childhood. So I'd like to welcome Tim Leslie, the Dakota County Sheriff, to the committee. Sheriff Leslie, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Davney. This is Tim Leslie. I'm the sheriff in Dakota County, and I'm here today representing not just Dakota County, but I'm also representing the 87 sheriffs of the Minnesota Sheriffs Association. I also would like to thank Representative Richardson and Senator Duckworth, both from Dakota County, for being on this conference committee. This is a pay me now or pay me later proposition in a law enforcement mindset. I work in the pay me later field. One of my responsibilities as sheriff is to manage a jail. Today in Dakota County, I have 206 adults in custody under my responsibility. We have a 263-bed jail here in Dakota. It costs the taxpayers $14 million a year to maintain and operate that jail. 24/7 nursing, mental health counseling, addiction recovery, addiction management, GED writing. We help with resume writing. It's quite the operation. I would also suggest, representatives, senators, if you get a chance to go and visit your local jail and visit with the sheriff, get an opportunity to walk behind the door and see what's going on in there. I think you'd be shocked and surprised at what's going on. This is an investment upstream towards proven methods that work. Quality preschool does work. It'll reduce future incarcerations. It will help our youth. It'll increase high school graduation rates. The research says it. Law enforcement supports it. All kids need the stimulation and opportunity to learn. Please support additional funding for early childhood, quality early childhood education for all, but especially towards those kids who, due to no fault of their own, live in poverty. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. Appreciate your taking the time today. Moving on, we recognize that students can't receive instruction and can't learn if they're not in school. So we wanted to ask Tanya Drawn, and Ms. Drawn, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name there, a parent, to talk to us about the issues around non-exclusionary discipline and the disparities we see in our state in terms of discipline. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair and committee members. Thank you for having me here today. I know that the majority of the bill is on literacy, but we cannot teach children if they're not in the classroom. And so I just wanted to hone in on a point of the importance of banning the suspensions on our youngest learners, our kindergarten through third grade learners, and the importance of making sure that they feel valued, that they feel accepted into their classroom, knowing that if they make a mistake, that the ultimate penalty of missing school is not what they're going to face. And we do know there are extreme circumstances, and we're not saying those extreme circumstances, but we are saying for the basic behaviors that you'll see in our youngest learners from kindergarten to third grade, it's important to make sure that they understand that mistakes can happen and that we learn from our mistakes and there are ways to deal with mistakes. That doesn't mean that there's isolation for that. I am a parent, I am a grandmother, I am an auntie. I have many children that I serve during a homework help. But the whole reason why I got involved in education advocacy was the treatment of my son. My son started kindergarten in fifth grade because he was very smart. He did 2 years of preschool, so he started in fifth grade. He was always the youngest learner. And right away in kindergarten, he got suspended. He got suspended for things like going into the bathroom for too long. He got suspended for play fighting, things that normal five-year-olds do. And it didn't just stop there. It started in kindergarten and went all the way through third grade until he had a teacher that really understood that when he was bored, he acted out. The consequences of suspending children is very real, and I have faced those consequences, and my community has faced those consequences. Luckily, my son is a very good reader, so literacy wasn't it for him, but he was probably bucking the trend. But he did get suspended, and that suspension followed him. He basically fit into those statistics that people are talking about. He did drop out of school, and it's been a fight ever since then to make sure that not only is he well taken care of, but that he continues his education in some way. He is now 22, going on 23, and is looking into how can he go back to finish school now. But it's been a struggle. It's been a struggle for him to find acceptance. It's been a struggle for him to learn from his mistakes in a way that he feels valued and know that everyone in life makes mistakes. And it's, I believe this all started because of his consequences he got early in life. And no matter what I do, no matter how much I loved on him, you know, he was in school the majority of the day. Unfortunately, I had to work. Well, fortunately, I had to work, but unfortunately, I couldn't be with him. I couldn't homeschool him. And I couldn't show him the value that he had. And I believe that because that missed value, that missed village circumstance that we all look for to help us raise our children, to help our standards of how we live and how we treat each other in society, because that was missed, because he was suspended for simple things that normal five-year-olds do, starting in kindergarten, going in first grade, going in second grade, getting multiple suspensions for silly things, throwing a pencil. And I know that that's dangerous. And I'm glad it didn't hurt anybody, but just redirecting him sometimes would have been a better option, making him feel valued. So I just want to let you know that literacy is the most important thing. There's so many things that literacy can help in a child's life, but if we don't have those children, if we don't have our youngest learners, our learners from kindergarten to third grade in those classrooms, it doesn't matter how much we talk about literacy, doesn't matter how much we talk about education funding, it doesn't matter how much we talk about it, because they're never going to realize that actuality of that investment that we placed in them, because they're not in that classroom. So I implore you to really take a look at it, to place a value on our K through three learners, to make sure that they understand the importance of being valued, of being taught lessons, of being taught ways to redirect actions that may be considered wrong, to keep them in the classroom, to make sure that our village is surrounding our children and loving on our children and giving them every opportunity they have to be successful, because that's what our ultimate goal is. And again, we can't talk about literacy if our babies aren't in the classroom. So I implore you to really take a look at the ban on suspensions for K through three and make sure that our learners know that the village loves them and is invested in them. And we're going to take care of everything from their literacy to English as second language and everything else. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Drawn. Appreciate that. And really, sets up the next conversation well. The House has a comprehensive literacy plan, and we'd like to explore that more fully now. I'd like to start with Amy Schulting, the dyslexia specialist at the Department of Education. Oh, pardon, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You probably didn't see my hand up. But I think what the parent has just pointed out is that sometimes the teacher has an issue with a child, and in speaking with principals, you know, they're very attuned today to that, and try to work with teachers who may have gotten a little bit carried away in, like, this five-year-old's behavior, because I'm sure the behavior was pretty normal. So, you know, that's important, and I think principals take care of that. But I also, Mr. Chair, have a question for the commissioner.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
And Commissioner, you know, I know that you believe in mandates, but I'm wondering why, when discipline is locally, a discipline policy is locally created and designed, why we have to be into this mandate arena now in this session with both the K-3 and the solutions, not suspensions. Why can't we let districts, because I know there are some that are doing this, handle this on their own?
Commissioner?
Chair Dabney and Representative Erickson, thank you very much for the question. I think a couple of things are important to note is that there are mandates that are important sometimes, not all the time. And so I think we're really clear in being able to distinguish when they are helpful and when they are not. I think the second piece is looking at non-exclusionary discipline practices. We know that being able to not only provide examples of differences between punishment and discipline, being able to help to identify and support the implementation and professional development around alternatives to suspensions, positive behaviors, interventions, and supports, and looking at providing that type of support really does mean that we have a more comprehensive and robust approach, and that it also is not dependent on where you are across the state, and gives you an opportunity to have that equity, and then where the nuances come in the ability to be able to provide that support is really in the local decision making, is how you decide to do that.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would still argue that local control is more important than the state mandating. I think we have so many different districts and charters across the state with different populations, different parent input, and we would be honoring them if we kept our hands off of this and let them proceed, because I know they'll make the right decision, and I know principals are working hard to ensure that students understand that rules are there. If you break them, there are consequences, because eventually they're going to be engaged in laws that they have to follow, and if they break those, there may be consequences. So I think that we need to really think carefully before we proceed with this mandate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Erickson, I think you raise good questions. Both the Senate has mandates in their bill. The House has some mandates in ours. We provide funding for teacher training, both in the literacy area and the discipline area. I think the question before this body is, when we see disparate racial impact across the state in discipline, is it sufficient to let that continue, or do we have an obligation to step in to ensure a more equitable educational experience for all students across the state and students regardless of their racial, ethnic, or religious background? Ms. Schulting, are you with us?
Yes. Chair Devney.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Schulting. Sometimes this hybrid thing is just a little something. So, Amy Schulting, Dr. Schulting, my apologies, the dyslexia specialist at the Minnesota Department of Education. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. You know the drill. Proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Devney. I'm Amy Schulting, and as you said, I'm the MDE dyslexia specialist. So Chair Devney, Chair Chamberlain, and members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you about MDE's vision for literacy achievement. MDE is laser focused on improving reading outcomes in Minnesota, and we're so grateful for your support of this work. I'll start with a quote by Dr. Louisa Moats. She is a literacy expert and author of letters, and she has often said that teaching reading is rocket science. This quote reminds us that we have long underestimated the complexity of teaching reading. Our policies and systems have not fully recognized the deep level of training, support, and resources that teachers need to successfully teach students to read. And our third grade reading scores reflect this. To accomplish bold literacy goals, there are a number of essential components of MDE's bold literacy proposal that I'd like to highlight today. We know first and foremost that teachers require deep knowledge based in the science of reading. An essential first step is professional development with a focus on foundational reading skills. This is critical. However, we also know that teacher knowledge alone is not enough. Teacher professional development alone will not change student outcomes. It is what comes after the training that makes the biggest difference in student achievement. Louisa Moats also states, and I quote, "Classroom instruction is the critical factor in preventing reading problems and must be the primary focus for change." So how do we move from teacher knowledge to changing classroom instruction? How do we make sure that teachers can apply what they've learned? We know that teachers cannot do it alone. Long-standing research shows that in addition to training, teachers also need coaching in order to transfer their knowledge into classroom instruction. Teachers also need instructional materials aligned with the science of reading to put their knowledge into action. We know that teachers are absolutely dedicated to their students, but they cannot do this alone. That is why our bold literacy proposal includes science of reading academies to build statewide capacity for training and coaching. It also includes putting trained science of reading coaches in all underperforming schools, much like Mississippi has done. Mississippi was very intentional in their rollout of statewide literacy reform efforts that include early literacy programs and professional development based on the science of reading, including letters training. A key reason that Mississippi has seen the improved literacy outcomes that they have is due to the level of support provided to teachers in addition to letters training. So for example, Mississippi hired literacy coaches to support the teachers completing letters in target schools. These coaches worked with teachers once or twice each week. Currently, the Mississippi Department of Education has over 80 literacy coaches working in the schools. Mississippi also provided letters training and coaching to literacy professors across the state. Mississippi has done many things right. However, there's one aspect of Mississippi's literacy reform effort that has received much less publicity, and that is their retention of low-performing students. Due to their 2013 Literacy-Based Promotion Act, Mississippi retains a higher percentage of students than any other state. For example, in 2018-19, according to State Department of Education reports, approximately 8% of students in each grade from K to 3 were retained, which was an increase from 6.6% the prior year. This means that over these four grades, as many as 32% of all Mississippi students were retained. However, as some students could be retained twice, the total retention rate is estimated to be closer to 20 to 25% of all kindergarten through third grade students. So the exact numbers are not known, as Mississippi's Department of Education does not report how many students are retained more than once. So this policy is concerning, as there is no evidence to support the effectiveness of grade retention for improving student outcomes. Therefore, we want to make clear that MDE does not support grade retention within the Minnesota Bold Literacy Plan. However, Minnesota or MDE's Bold Literacy Plan does reflect many of the other strategies used in Mississippi, including science of reading training and coaching specifically. One concern is that if Minnesota does not include this additional support for teachers as they complete letters, that the letters training being proposed will not have the desired impact on student outcomes. While we can be confident that letters training will improve teacher knowledge, research has shown that training alone will not be enough for most teachers to transfer this learning into changed classroom instruction. Therefore, like Mississippi, we're proposing a regional infrastructure to support educators and school leaders. Putting literacy specialists in the regional centers of excellence is certainly a great start. They will also need a team of science of reading trained specialists to support schools across the state. Therefore, the Bold Literacy proposal also includes redirecting literacy incentive aid to support comprehensive literacy reform efforts. And this includes having a highly trained dyslexia and reading specialist in each district. So this expert will have deep knowledge and training in the science of reading in order to lead literacy efforts consistent with Statute 120B12. Specifically, they will lead district efforts to screen and identify struggling readers and those with characteristics of dyslexia using a screener recommended by MDE. They will collaborate with the proposed regional literacy specialist to oversee teacher training and coaching. They will collaborate with MDE to submit literacy data and to refine and implement their local literacy plan. Having a district level dyslexia and reading specialist increases district capacity. And it also increases district accountability for the implementation of 120B12 and the local literacy plan. To wrap up, I'll briefly address two final topics, and those are dyslexia and data. It is clear that a focus on training and coaching classroom teachers is critical to reading outcomes. But as a state dyslexia specialist, I know that we also need to ask, what about students who need more? What about struggling readers and those with dyslexia who may need additional support beyond the core classroom? How do we ensure that they receive the best possible intervention in order to become proficient readers? Struggling readers, as we know, are not limited to K to 3 classrooms. That is why the Bold Literacy Plan includes science of reading training for elementary classroom teachers, as well as intervention teachers in both elementary and secondary grades. When students move up to tier 2 and tier 3 within the MTSS system, we need to intensify the instruction provided to students and intensify the training and support provided to intervention teachers. We need to ensure that intervention teachers have the deep expertise and support they need to teach struggling and dyslexic students how to read. Last but not least, how will we know if we're making progress? The answer is simple: data. Another critical aspect of the Bold Literacy Plan is data and an improved data system. Our goal is to achieve reading proficiency by third grade. But without data, we are flying blind. If a business wanted to improve sales, the first thing they would do is look at their baseline sales data and make a plan to increase those numbers. MDE does not have this baseline literacy data. So how will we track our progress and achieve success? We know that reading proficiently by third grade does not start in third grade. It starts at school entry with mastery of foundational reading skills. Therefore, data from the earlier grades is essential. And without it, we cannot chart a course to achieve reading proficiency by third grade. In closing, I hope you will support the Bold Literacy proposal for science of reading training and coaching, regional and district level specialists, intensifying instruction for struggling readers within an MTSS framework, and the data that is needed to achieve bold literacy outcomes in Minnesota. Thank you very much for your time and attention to this important topic.
Thank you, Dr. Schulting. Next on our list, Jessica Town Gunderson, Director of Teaching and Learning from the Princeton Public Schools. Ms. Town Gunderson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. This is Jessica Town Gunderson. I'm the Director of Teaching and Learning at Princeton Public Schools, and I would love to share my screen with you if that's all right.
Sure. Okay. I marvel at the technology. Look at that.
All right. I'll just start by saying I believe deeply that if we ever want equitable outcomes for students, then what our role must be is to ensure that they can read. I'll also say I love working in public schools because it is chock full of people who care deeply about whether students thrive or not and are willing to work ridiculously hard to support the students in our care. What I'd like to do is give you a glimpse into when a district is indeed jumping into learning about and implementing science of reading across their classrooms, the task at hand. So knowing that science of reading was not something that is historically learned in teacher prep programs, it becomes our responsibility at the district level, or I would argue state level, to make sure that all teachers in the profession now have access to this information. When we think about getting this to everyone, and I will also say this is not work for the faint of heart. So when teachers engage in letters training, which is the best way I know of to understand the science of reading, and if they are going full force, it takes 2 years at 72 hours per year of learning and practicing outside of the classroom, in addition to trying in the classroom with their students. What that translates to is at the district level, if we want to go that fast, we have to pay teachers outside of their contract time to do the learning. If a district is going to move ahead with letters training within the contract day, that will stretch the learning out to between 4 and 8 years to get all of the letters training that we need. So it is complex when we say teaching reading is rocket science. There is a lot of detail that is uncovered during the trainings, and then it also really helps to marinate in that new information to be able to apply it to a classroom. At a systems level, You've got to think about all of your classrooms and all of your learning spaces simultaneously and separately, because school districts are very complex systems full of many complex systems. So you'll notice I've got a column here for our classroom teachers. Even within a grade level, when you have multiple classrooms, there is room for differentiation from class to class. So what we need to ensure is that teachers in every classroom, when they're working ridiculously hard, they're prioritizing and choosing those things that actually make the most impact in student learning. So even within a lane, there's some complexity to deal with and focus on. But classroom daily instruction is not the only lane you have to think about from a systems perspective. So we have, of course, our interventionists who are there to provide a second scoop or extra skills-based practice of those things that students are not yet learning or mastering within the classroom time. And then we have another structure around special education and students that qualify for that. We've got to ensure that the teachers in that lane also are applying and have deep knowledge of the science of reading so that they most leverage the time they have with their students. You've got targeted services programs running in the school year or during the school year in the afternoons. You've also got it running during the summer. And it's vital that you do both data collection to identify which students need the services, which skills they have to have filled, and then match the intervention directly to those skill gaps. So you see there's some complexity within each of these lanes. I don't want to leave out the administrative lane and other teacher supports, because it's equally important that the administrators in the building and the district understand the science of reading and how complex it is to learn and implement, so that they are supporting. We've got to have that constant pressure to move forward and support to do the work, right? So leaders need to understand the complexity of the work in order to provide the time, the materials, the support and training and coaching, like as what was referred to. It will take all of that to change a system. And I left a little gap between each lane because sometimes they don't talk well with each other, and you got to make sure to bridge the gap in order to get the whole system running smoothly. All right. So this is the role. This is what we're asking districts to do. And this is what we are in the midst of doing in Princeton Public Schools right now. So in addition, my slide's not, you bragged about the technology too early. You've got to have leadership understanding of implementation science. So that whole idea that you'll have early adopters, and then when people start to see the results, they get excited and a next group wants in. And then eventually you get the entire group. But what we're doing at Princeton Public Schools was just an open invitation to all of our pre-K through fifth grade teachers to sign up for letters training in their off hours. We did have 30% of our teachers, which if you know anything about implementation science, that's 20% more than would be normal for early adopters to jump on board and say, I'm ready from the get-go. But 30 of our teachers, primarily in kindergarten, first grade, and our intervention programs, as well as some special ed teachers who jumped in on that first cohort. We are ending the first half of our training this year. So the next year, 22-23, it should be labeled, is when that cohort, including myself, including our literacy coach, including our building principals, we are moving to the second half of letters training. So it will take us two full years just with outside time to make it through the training. We've also got, and I'm pleased to report, because of the hype and the enthusiasm of the teachers and leaders in the first cohort, I'm offering a second cohort to begin next year, and 85% of our third through fifth grade teachers completed a survey that they are ready now. So they will register for a second cohort to start the units 1 through 4 next year. that will not be enough. So yes, we do need coaching support. We do need administrators looking for the same things in classrooms as we visit to make sure that implementation is happening across the system. When we get to 23-24, our second cohort will finish their second half, I'm hoping, and, you know, fingers crossed, it was still an opt-in program, but for anyone who was not ready now, we're considering them ready next, and then we will be building into the teacher contract day the time for all the remaining teachers to get the learning. We've also got to consider going forward that this work never stops. We will be on continuous improvement forever until we have 100% readers at every grade level. And we have got to make sure that we welcome new teachers into our district with the same knowledge base as our existing teachers have. I do want to mention there's a pitfall also in relation to the materials that you use in classrooms. This is a significant investment for school districts, and they typically commit to a program for between 4 and 8 years. So if you make a large purchase and you're committed for 8 years, and it's a balanced literacy approach, we have another issue on our hands. So we've got to have a way to get teachers the materials and tools they need, even when there's that type of a situation. So the way that we did materials review was simultaneous with our letters learning. We did review last year and did our very best to make sure that we weren't even considering anything that didn't align with the science of reading. We picked 2 pilots for teachers to try. And when I say we go about selecting materials, there's 3 criteria. Number one, no matter what, is it aligned to science of reading? And there are far too many materials out there that will lead you astray by saying science of reading, but not actually being science of reading. They caught on to marketing. But number two, you've got to look at the student learning data. So to pick your materials and move forward with confidence, you've got to watch if students are actually making the gains that you predict. And then teacher feedback is important in terms of how easy is it to implement the materials within the classroom. Once the decision is made, you've got to make sure that you're repeating those science of reading messages so that teachers never stop prioritizing the most important pieces of the materials.
Ms. Town Gunderson, thank you for this overview. We appreciate the thoroughness and the local implementation issues that you've raised and reviewed for us. So thank you for your time today. Next, Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Education. Assistant Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner, Office of Teaching and Learning at Department of Ed. Just going to briefly, in 2 minutes, in closing, I just would like to take a few minutes to highlight how aligned our bold literacy plan is to the priorities you just heard from both Amy and Jessica, but also addresses the priorities we have heard from both the House and the Senate, and that we share the same sense of urgency to address our literacy achievement rates. And as you heard today, our Minnesota Bold Literacy Plan ensures that all children in Minnesota, especially those consistently underserved, will be on a pathway to achieving grade level literacy beginning at birth through building educator and leader capacity to implement evidence-based literacy practices based in the science of reading, to opening doors to family and community members in intentional, collaborative, equitable partnerships, to leading in data-based decision-making to inform instruction, educator development, and policy, and driving implementation and sustainability of a comprehensive literacy system within the Minnesota MTSS framework. Through the Minnesota MTSS framework, which was illustrated so beautifully by Jessica in their work in Princeton through the system alignment, we will see increased access to effective literacy experiences for all students, with a focus on those most underserved, by ensuring school leaders and educators are trained in the science of reading, effectively implement and measure instructional practices aligned to state standards, and utilize data literacy to inform instruction, educator development, resource deployment and policy, and employ instructional, family, and community engagement strategies. Thank you. And thank you for prioritizing literacy for our children and families of Minnesota.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Next, Natalia Alvarez-Benjamin, English Language Learning and Ethnic Studies with the Rochester Public Schools. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Natalia Benjamin, Rochester Public Schools. Chair Daphne and Chair Chamberlain and members of the committee, I'm an English Learners and Ethnic Studies teacher in Rochester, and I'm also the 2021 Minnesota Teacher of the Year. I grew up speaking Spanish and French in Guatemala City and learning English in middle school, and I have a passion for languages, and I use this passion to help guide students through their own language acquisition progress. In order for our students to be successful, both in their home language and in English-speaking classrooms, students need to also feel this passion. And for students to find joy in reading and learning, they need to both discover the world and see themselves in the world. I urge the conference committee to include House provisions strengthening English learner programs in their final bill. 9% of the kids in our schools, or about 1 out of every 11 kids, is an English learner. By increasing English learner funding, teachers and administrators can make the best decisions for their students to meet their needs. That's not the cheapest. English learner programs done right can be expensive, and it is incredibly important to develop strong relationships with students, which requires small classrooms. Small classrooms are essential to address both academic and relational needs. One of my classes at the end of the day is particularly active. And one of the reasons why this class is challenging is because the majority of these students can use one-on-one help as we work on different academic tasks. Addressing both learning the content and teaching the mechanics of the language requires special attention. This can be difficult when most students have different language abilities and the background knowledge necessary to understand classroom topics. Because we need to incorporate language lessons across all subject areas, teachers need more specialized lesson plans and time to digest the material. This is a monumental task when trying to address the individual needs of students in large class sizes. In addition to this, we incorporate technology to develop media literacy skills. All of this takes time in the classroom and additional support from teachers and education assistants. Co-teaching models have proven effective to meet the needs of multilingual students and other students in the classroom. For example, when I have co-taught blended classes, I build classroom supports for multilingual students. And these help all the students in the classroom, both students with IEPs or 504s, or students who need reading help, or those who benefit from concrete steps on school assignments. In the contemporary literature class that I have co-taught, we use graphic organizers, and these are used for writing to help students with the writing. And while these aids in the class were optional, the majority of the students used them, including high achievers, and thus improved the outcomes and the quality of writing that the students produce. That this cannot be done if we don't have enough staffing to be able to staff co-taught classes. Research has also shown that multilingual learners' English skills grow faster and better when they have home language maintenance support and literacy. However, this is seldom supported in schools. We need to fund programs that would allow for heritage language literacy development because in return, that would reduce gaps in academic success. Support for home language doesn't only benefit multilingual students, it also benefits communities in Minnesota as it would prepare our future generations for a growingly diverse world. All of our children will have increased access to language education and this would open economic opportunities at home and abroad. We need to fund schools that will prepare Minnesotans for success in a competitive global economy. It is worth noting that literacy is more than just being able to decode the words on the page. Reading for learning happens when children discover the magic of knowledge through print. This usually occurs when they find texts that speak to them. As an ethnic studies teacher, I get to see the positive impact of students seeing themselves reflected in lessons. It fills my heart with joy to teach my students in a way that speaks to their background, to see themselves reflected in the curriculum, and to know that their cultural history is joyful. This sparks a curiosity in lessons that helps students dive deeper into their coursework. All of this requires funding to update libraries and fund media specialists that can work with all students. Text should not only represent all the communities our students come from, but also their interests. Our students deserve up-to-date books and materials that speak to their personal experiences and histories. EL classrooms often have their own books and text resources to meet the unique needs of our students. These libraries are often limited when there isn't enough funds to pay for the books our students need. As students develop their literacy skills, it's vital that we find materials that are high interest and age appropriate, as well as at the correct reading levels. Without this joy, students can sometimes lose passion for their schooling. It becomes drudgery and hypothetical because it doesn't speak to them. This is part of the reason why past literacy efforts have failed, because they did not address students' diverse backgrounds. We must always center students in our work. Literacy development, especially for language learners, is more effective when it's contextualized through hands-on activities rather than based on rote memorization. We must consider that students to engage in the post-distance learning world, we need to address their needs to be ready to learn. Many of my students lost loved ones these past 2 years, or have been separated from family members, or have lost their homes. As students share their stories through various writing assignments on where they make connections to stories we read, they share their struggles as they're coming back to study in person. The social anxiety that's present, the depression and the stresses our students have endured are often shared when students feel comfortable with our classroom community. We need to make sure that they have the emotional vocabulary and skills to respond to these traumatic events. We need to fund more mental health practitioners, social workers, and school counselors so that when students walk into the classroom, they're ready to learn. Lastly, I want to put on the record that this is not a metro or rural issue. I teach in Southeast Minnesota in Rochester Public Schools. And many communities like Beaumont or Worthington have significant English learner populations, and every school has at least a few students receiving EL instruction. Teaching EL classes is not easier in small communities. In fact, delivering EL services can be even tougher. I'm lucky to be one of four teachers delivering English language instruction to high schoolers in my building. In some communities, they're not as lucky and may have only one EL teacher. This means that during the month that students are receiving the access test to assess their English skills, the teacher is only proctoring tests and the EL students receive no instruction. We cannot make real movement on addressing the opportunity gap when a month of instruction is lost every year in these settings. Delivering EL services only becomes more challenging as the world gets smaller. Many multilingual students that attend our schools have faced challenging experiences. A senior just shared that they had a good life and they didn't want to leave their country. Their mother taught Arabic back home, but when the war reached them, they had no choice but to move. Another student shared how their parents are working, and so if the school was out the next day and everybody else didn't have school, they would have to babysit and would not be able to attend a club activity. So as I have gotten to know these students and families, I have seen their dedication, their work ethic, and their perseverance to succeed in school. However, we don't always have the staff needed to co-teach all the necessary content areas or to provide homework help and classroom support. As the news of other conflicts around the world reach us, I imagine that next year at this time, I may have a number of Ukrainian students in my program. They will have witnessed the war firsthand and will need all the supports that we can provide, both academically and for their mental health.
Ms. Benjamin, thank you. That's a powerful place to stop. Thank you very much. Next on our agenda is Giovanni Ford and Nubia Amina from the Network for the Advancement of Children of African Descent. Mr. Ford, Ms. Amina, please come forward. Good to see you both. You. State your name for the record and proceed, please. Thank you.
Chair Daphne, Chair Chamberlain, and members, my name is Brother Giovanni Ford. I'm the founder and executive director of Network for the Development of Children of African Descent.
Hi, Chairman, and my name is Nubia Amina, and I'm one of the parents, a part of NNCAD. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity to share just a little bit of our work and 25 years worth of learning how to change the trajectory for African and African American children when it comes to reading. But it's not just about changing the learning trajectory for our children, because children come from families. And so our work is with the children as well as with parents and community members. And so our holistic, whole family, whole community approach over the past 25 years has produced outcomes that are measurable and sustainable. We look at and honor culture as a resource for engaging children and their parents in their own learning. One of our staff is always reminding us through our programs, we don't do things to families. We set the stage and create the conditions for families, children, and parents alike to take charge of their own education and learning trajectory. And so over the years, we have designed a series of learning models. We call them programs. We have an intensive reading intervention program, which gives our children an opportunity to experience success with reading skill development so that when they go into the school, they're going with a changed mindset that's based on some success. We also have designed a parent engagement program called Parent Power Literacy and Advocacy Workshops that help parents understand and demystify the whole complexity around literacy and reading development. When parents understand and children understand that it's not an issue of our children's ability, it's about how we engage them. We have to reach our children in order to teach them. It's not difficult to teach children the five dimensions of reading: phonemic awareness, phonics, decoding, comprehension, fluency, and vocabulary. It's not difficult to teach children to master and practice the seven metacognitive comprehension strategies. But through our work, we understand when parents understand how reading is taught, how reading is encouraged, how the thinking inside of reading occurs, then they're equipped to be that first and lifelong teacher and create those strong literacy and cultural practices at home that translates to the support that our children need when they're receiving instruction from school. Final thing I'll say about our outcomes: what we've seen consistently over years is that when our children go through our 9-week intervention, they have a 2 to 5 level increase in independent guided reading levels, increase in the reading skills. In 2018, we were able to conclude a 5-year research evaluation study with Carey out of the University of Minnesota and some of our community partners. And we looked at nearly 400 of our K through third African American students in St. Paul. What the research found was that before our 9-week intervention, decodable word skills were actually on the decline. But during our culturally based intervention, self-doubt was extinguished. And children's language changed from "I can't" to "I can." That's all we need to hear. Then they're open to mastering the skills. 6 weeks after the program ended, the data showed that decodable word skills were continuing to increase. So we're talking about a change of trajectory, and how do we sustain that change in trajectory by making sure that parents and families have what they need to support themselves and their children. So thank you for this opportunity to share a little bit of our work. If we have time, I'd really love to have you hear directly from a parent who has been and continues to be impacted by the work. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Amina, Mr. Ford just referenced parents.
Hi, good morning. My name is Nubia Amina, so I'm a sign language interpreter. I just recently graduated. So I just want to briefly just talk about what I've learned since being involved. Literacy is a key importance in my family, and I was excited in 2021 that they had NCAD, which was a Black organization. I am a child of deaf parents, so my first language was sign language. So it was a challenge for me growing up because I needed to know how to read. That was important, but I never had NCAD. So I'm a visual learner. And I realized that my children are visual learners. So with this program, they taught me how to have learned the vocabularies of independent reading levels, guided reading levels, and overall how to teach my children to read. Once they gave me those vocabularies, I was able to sit down with their teachers and learn what their levels were, and also sit down with my children and figure out how they prefer how to learn. And all three of my children are the same with me. We're visual learners. So we like to touch, see, and be involved in what the teacher's doing and what's going on in the classroom. I was excited to hear also they have a program called Sankofa, which helps children learn how to read, which my children just fell in love with it, like really fell in love with it. They had the opportunity to see that they're self-esteem get increased, the opportunity to see that they can read, and be able to see that they can be visual learners and also have the opportunity to read. I'm also involved in their Parent Power program. I've been able to collaborate understanding about the deaf culture and the hearing culture and bridge them together. I talked about Anton Hunter, who was a poet. Claudia Gordon. She was one of the first black women who worked in the White House with Obama. And also Andrew Foster, who was the first black man to get a BA degree and go to Africa and teach their literacy there in Africa. So my experience with NCAD has been very, very wonderful. They have supported me and gave me a letter of recommendation and helped me to become a freelance interpreter, as well as a VRS, which is a video relay interpreter as well. So I thank you for this opportunity to provide my history and my children's experience with NCAD. Thank you.
Ms. Amina, thank you for bringing your story and your experience to the conference committee today. Much appreciated. Mr. Ford, thank you very much for returning to the House committee and to being here as well today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, Mr. Chair?
We also have some handouts if
staff could support Mr. Ford there. Mr. Chair, you've got a question.
I apologize. I've not heard of your organization, but it's not often that I learn something new and hopeful with education. But your talk of families and parents being part of that and working on the science of reading, I think you've shown a path and kind of a model for public schools to follow as well. Engaging parents, family, and working on those critical, the basic science reading stuff. So I'm really, really interested in that approach. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last on our agenda for the few minutes we have left is a parent, Mr. Chair. Seems appropriate, don't you think? It's Sarah Carlson-Walrath. Ms. Carlson-Walrath, good morning. Welcome
good
to the
morning.
Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Sarah Carlson-Walrath, and I am the mom of two school-aged kids. I'll make this as short as I can because I know we're running out of time, so I will be brief. I work professionally for dyslexia and literacy nonprofits, but at the same time, I'm raising an 11-year-old autistic son. And it's from that unique perspective that I've learned both how reading instruction should look and how too many kids like mine are moving through the process without the right instruction to gain the fundamental skill of reading. So in brief, my son was a fourth grader and he was still not able to read at a word level, despite his hard work and despite showing up every day and working hard. He wasn't learning and he knew he wasn't learning. And as many parents can relate, this internalized failure led to behaviors at school and at home. We made the decision as a family to homeschool, which is a really privileged place to be. I took Orton-Gillingham training at cost to my family and began using that with my son at home. And I'm pleased to share with you that he's made incredible gains that would probably shock the teachers that worked with him in public school. He went from not even reading at a word level to being able to read at a second or a third grade level within a year. Systematic, cumulative, multi-sensory language instruction works for all kids, including kids who are behavioral, have attention issues, et cetera. I really wish that from the very beginning of his academic career, he had been in a school that embraced the science of reading. So addressing our education system's reluctance to make big changes to structured literacy is multifaceted. And I'm here to just urge you to take some of the really great things that are in the House bill and the Senate bill and the governor's plan and come to some consensus in the next week so that we can make some progress on literacy. Just real briefly, the two specific things I just want to touch on are urging you to require districts adopt a comprehensive plan to have 90% of third grade students achieve grade level proficiency. Science indicates that upwards of 95% of students can learn to read. So regardless of a student's demographics or disability, every student should be presumed to be able to learn, should have access to curriculum and method of instruction supported by science and designed to achieve proficiency. It also would be great to prohibit some of the instructional practices that we know are antithetical to science and get those out of classrooms. We need you in this committee to take a leadership role and on literacy by passing these bold plans. because there are too few schools that are and too few schools that even know how to make a jump towards structured literacy.
So, Ms. Carlson-Wohlrath, thank you so much for that, charge to the committee. Mr. Chair, we've got House File 4300 and Senate File 4113 that set the table for us. We've got a charge from a parent to be bold. We've got charges from others to be comprehensive in our approach. Looking forward, you've been adamant in the past before that those two bills set the table for our consideration, and I appreciate that. I know Majority Leader Miller stressed the importance of the special education cross-subsidy today and our responsibility to stand up to paying our bills. I'm wondering when we can anticipate an offer from the Senate.
Well, Mr. Chair, we gave you an offer last Thursday, which was ignored. And you mentioned yesterday to bring an offer forward in the late afternoon, mid-afternoon, and that just isn't possible on a Sunday and coming into Monday morning. If you have one to counter what we gave last Thursday, or if you have a new one to put forward, we're happy to take a look at it and get to it and kind of short-circuit it a little bit. So if you got one, send it over, and then we can just adapt what we have instead of writing up a whole new proposal to start with.
Well, Mr. Chair, the agreement we had yesterday is that both bodies would simultaneously share offers that balance to the targets. We didn't have that target when you gave that small proposal last week. We would continue with the agreement from yesterday.
You got your agreement. You can send it over if you have it done. Ours isn't finished. I don't know when it would be finished, but send it over. We'll take a look. That's usually how it works. Offer, counteroffer. We gave one first. You were waiting for yours to come over. Take a look and we can get it going. Tomorrow I anticipate discussing those. If we don't have your counter or your offer over to us, then there won't be much to discuss at tomorrow's conference committee. So looking forward to that, Mr. Chair, to cut through the clutter. If you got it, send it over. We're going to look at it and we'll get one back to you.
So, Mr. Chair, I just remind you of our agreement yesterday, which was that both parties would provide offers today that squared to the budget targets we received. We're in a new world with those budget targets. That was our agreement. We stayed up late. My team worked hard last night to comply with the agreement that you and I reached yesterday. I want to thank them for that long, hard, and late work. Leadership has indicated that we have 2 days to resolve this, and delay is not on the table. When can we anticipate an offer from the Senate that balances to the target that we've received?
We gave you an offer Thursday, ignored it, and if you have one written, send it over, we'll get one back to you. It's that easy. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you and I also discussed negotiating in good faith, and the absence of a offer from the Senate that balances to the target, I don't believe aligns with that agreement to operate in good faith, or that agreement that you would follow through with a offer that balances to the target. When can we anticipate that so we can get involved in the real back and forth of finding an agreement?
Give us your offer. I've been to this dance before, in case you've forgotten. So send it over. You got it written up? Easy. Send it over. We'll get it done. That agreement was brief, tentative, and a lot of things weren't known at the time. So if you got one written, you did all that work, send it over. We're happy to take a look. Hate to for all that work to go to waste, Mr. Chair. So we're ready to do it. We were ready last Thursday. So last Monday and last Wednesday, we, instead of doing conference committee work, we did House committee work again. We tried to progress it on Tuesday and then again on Thursday. Friday, of course, was a long-planned absence for other events. And today, again, we have more committee hearings, some good information, but we've been ready to go since last Monday. We didn't, the House chose to do committee hearings instead of doing a walkthrough of the side-by-side and the spreadsheets, so the Senate picked that up on Tuesday. On Wednesday, again, committee hearings, and we had to wait till Thursday to finish the walkthrough on the spreadsheets, which is typical, normal process in the conference committee. We then offered you a proposal to try to jumpstart the discussions. Our proposal did not have any numbers in it. It was just a high-level, simple jumpstart and kickoff to it. Again, that was ignored. So the Senate position has been to try to do conference committee work and get it done. The House has been stalling and not presenting and moving forward with that conference committee work. Now, if you have a proposal, we're happy to look at it. We have been working through things, but we're happy to look at the proposal, send it over, and we'll get to it, and tomorrow we can discuss it and maybe get some work done. But please don't try to tell me we haven't been trying to get something done. We have. It is unfortunate that we've had to waste time instead of conference committee negotiations and work. So I really have nothing more to say. You can talk and talk and talk if you wish. But tomorrow the Senate will have a hearing. We will post it. And please pay attention. If we don't have an offer to discuss, we shall not be meeting. So it's that simple, Mr. Chair. Send it over. We can meet tomorrow. And we can do work like we've been trying to do for last week.
Mr. Chair, we now have a joint target. So what was offered last week is immaterial at this point. The agreement that you and I reached and the tradition in both these bodies on how conference committee works is that both bodies bring forward offers that balance to the target. We are awaiting a Senate offer. You've indicated that it would be simple. Our team stayed up late, did the work, and is prepared. We will await an offer from the Senate. I would like to see this conference committee proceed, but if the Senate is unwilling to align with its agreements, I think we're going to have trouble with that. And yesterday, that was our agreement, and I expect that, Mr. Chair, you're a man of your word.
I'm done speaking. We are done. Thank you.
We'll look forward to a proposal from the Senate. With that, we are adjourned.